Pilot TV podcast this week, we join a blood-soaked Mark Strong as he heads into London's underbelly in Temple, catch up with BAFTA-winning Top Boy after a six-year absence, and dig deep into a true crime case with Caitlin Dever and Toni Collette in Netflix drama Unbelievable. I'm Terry White, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast. Once again, within just two short weeks, we are without James Dyer, who, after trotting off to Star Wars, has got into America once again, this time seemingly without incident, to, well, go on some roller coasters. We're not even kidding. Who is paying him for this shit? But don't fear, I am here, I am not alone, for that would be a very tedious podcast. I am joined by the other constant in my life, the Jacob Rees-Mogg to my Boris Johnson, the man who by the end of this podcast will be slumped down across three seats like a giant spoiled toddler. It's Boyd Hilton.
God, compared to Jacob Rees-Mogg, that's painful. Mind you, you've compared yourself to Boris Johnson.
Right?
Yeah.
That's, topical.
Yeah, very topical. Okay, fine. We'll deal with it.
I mean, you couldn't look and be more unlike
true
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
No, that is true. Yeah, but I do sprawl.
Boris Johnson,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I do like to sprawl across three seats, though. Yeah,
yeah.
That's just general, not general behaviour. Yeah.
We could fit, I think, six Boyds in one Jacob Rees-Mogg.
I don't even know what that means, but yeah. Yeah, I think so. Can I just say I'm furious that James isn't here for second out of 3 weeks. Just unacceptable behaviour.
I know.
And he's still texting me about the show from wherever the fuck he from Florida or something.
At like midnight the other
telling
night.
Telling me to watch Peaky Blinders, which, by the way, I did.
He was texting us at midnight the other night and he was like, Broxy, blah, blah, blah. James Splane,
exactly
James Splane from... And I like the fact we both just ignored it as well, which means he's fuming somewhere, probably, definitely on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
To his left, you just heard him, is another first-timer on the Pilot TV podcast, who we will be hoping doesn't defect to the Liberal Democrats, aka the Empire podcast, part of way through this recording. It's writer, critic, broadcaster. Hope I haven't left anything out. Amon Warman. Amon, welcome.
Thank you. You did leave something out, though.
Go on.
Video editor.
Video, see? I knew I had. I'll get your CV next time. How do you feel about being on the podcast?
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Actually, I thought I better have something prepared because I have been sort of listening to the Pilot podcast. Mm-hmm. And I, too, did not know what V2 filth means. So I did copious amounts of research, meaning that I typed in V2 filth meaning into Google and found out what it means. Would you like me to bestow this knowledge upon you?
Yes, because all we know is Ben Travis's definition. This was on the podcast, 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago when Ben covered for James, where he introduced us to read me to filth. So what is the actual definition, Amon?
This is from Urban Dictionary, and I quote, "To read is to harshly critique or insult someone with your quick wit." That is what
read to filth.
Is it read for filth officially? Is that what you're telling us? Are you telling us that
we've
Ben
been using
got
it wrong? And also, I think that means the whole usage is wrong, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Read also, for filth. It's read for filth.
Oh, this is a whole new. You've opened a whole can of worms here.
Has it as read someone to filth, and they have it as to thoroughly insult or to comprehensively call attention to the flaws of someone.
Does this mean RuPaul is using it wrong as well?
RuPaul can do what she wants. She's got her own way of expressing herself.
Yeah. Read to filth, read for filth.
Yeah.
It all works for me. And Amon, we should say that actually you wrote the cover story of the new issue of Pilot TV, which came out Thursday with Empire. If you haven't got it, what have you been doing? Get your ass to the shops. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that cover story?
Yeah. It was funny. I actually didn't clock that I was writing the cover story until this came through my letterbox. I was like, oh, I did that article. Oh, so that was cool. So yeah, it's about Marvel TV on Disney Plus, and I give you some informed speculation on what might happen in Loki, in WandaVision, in Hawkeye, and in The Falcon and The Winter Soldier. The Falcon and Winter Soldier is one I'm especially excited
for. Yeah.
Also, What If, I'm forgetting that one.
Yeah.
That's also very exciting. So yeah, that was fun to write.
We just want it all now, don't we? That's the problem.
There's such a long wait.
I know.
I need my Marvel fix immediately.
I know. We can't do another What Is Happening with Disney Plus thing, but What Is Happening with Disney Plus?
We could, yeah.
Right, so let's get to what we're watching. I mean, we're all watching one thing, right? The greatest drama, comedy, thriller, satire that's ever been broadcast, which is live Parliament telly.
Ah, yes.
What a week.
Yeah.
Has anyone else just been addicted to it? I put it on in the office when I was doing some work, honestly. And we had it on in the background. And then I got home and put it on. And it just seemed to be going for like 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And it's just been, this week has just been, we're recording this on Friday afternoon, extraordinary stuff going on in there, like Jacob Rees-Mogg and his, I wouldn't even call it man spreading, I'd call it like posh dickhead spreading, which isn't as articulate, but you get my point. Just extraordinary scenes that actually, you know, if you wrote them into a TV series or a film, the notes from the studio would be like two on the nose. Nobody would believe it. Just the most crazy, crazy, crazy scenes. And it's actually like distracted me away from actual telly.
It is incredible. Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah, I've been watching. I haven't been tuning in to particularly to the Parliament channel, which has ratings have gone up massively. It is getting its highest ratings ever. I think there was one time when 800,000 or nearly a million people were watching, which is unheard of.
That's incredible.
But I have been watching Daily Politics on BBC Two pretty much every day, Newsnight every day, and quite a lot of live coverage on the BBC News channel, and listening to quite a lot of it on Radio 4 and 5 Live. So pretty much every other avenue there is. And definitely the peak, the moment you're talking about, you know, you would be asked to, you'd get a note telling you to take out implausible developments. The best one for me was when Boris Johnson did his speech in front of all those police cadets.
Oh my God.
They were forced to stand there waiting for him for an hour before he even got there. And it was quite hot. And one of them practically fainted towards the end of his rambling, incoherent nonsense. And he couldn't really deal with it. And he meant to kind of look to him and, oh, I should wrap up now. And then didn't do anything about it. And she was there kind of fainting or whatever happened to her. That was, again, people would go, no, that's not going to happen.
That can't happen.
Natural world, yeah.
Somebody compared it to that footage, you know, of Obama when a very similar thing happened.
Yeah.
And I think a female cadet fainted behind him and he immediately was like, what's happening? Are you all right? Picked her up.
Human
got somebody.
Being.
Yeah, it's been extraordinary. Yeah. Amon, has it been?
I've seen little bits of it online, but it's too depressing for me to do. I mean, you are watching a bit on every platform.
It's an addiction.
Yeah, it's too depressing for me. I have been watching The Dark Crystal.
Okay.
Which is really, really good.
I mean, there are similarities. There are similarities. Gexies!
Just in the cinematic into the television landscape, which is dominated by computer effects. It's really cool to see something this old school puppetry on a grand scale. And that's been really good, really fun to watch. Daniel Pemberton, I'm a big fan of, he did the score for that as well. And it's one of the best pieces of music I've heard all year. So highly recommend seeking that out. I've been watching this of all the new stuff, actually.
Okay.
I've been rewatching Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I used to watch it growing up with the family all the time and obviously really, really enjoyed it. But it's different watching it with adult eyes. And it's really impressive how the film, the show, it dealt with race and privilege in really smart ways.
Mm.
And now sort of rewatching it at this stage in my life, I can better appreciate that. So that's been fun. I've been the news of the Obi-Wan Kenobi TV show has inspired me to rewatch The Clone Wars, which in turn...
Really?
Oh, it's really good. It actually led me to remind me of the first thing I ever did for Pilot or Empire ever, I think, which was when my interview with David Filoni.
Yes.
First issue of Pilot. But yeah, it's really, really good. Obi-Wan has some really great storylines in that show, actually, with Darth Maul, with Satine, so... Yeah.
It's like James never went away.
I know, I was going to say.
It really is.
We never knew how good this fit would be.
Yeah.
I'm still sort of working my way through it, but Wu Assassins is on Netflix and I'm...
Oh, yeah.
And it's just nice to watch an Iko Uwe fight scene where the camera is put in the right place and we can actually watch him
work. Yeah.
Because his recent film appearances have not done that. The camera is shaking, they're cutting it to pieces in the edit, and I'm like... You hired Iko Uwe. Let him be Iko Uwe. Literally, just put the camera there, go have lunch. You know,
yeah.
Just let him do his thing. So it's good to watch that and appreciate Iko Uwe doing this thing, because as anybody who's watched The Raid knows, the guy is amazing. So I'm still working my way through that too.
What a week.
Yeah, that's a lot.
What are you doing?
Well, since James sent us the message, a joint message, saying, and I quote, proxy thought for the podcast, Peaky Blinders episode 4, fucking hell. What an incredibly made episode of television. Best series yet, I'm saying, which was, as you say, last night at 2:35 a.m.
Oh my God.
In fact. So I have watched it. So this is the episode that will have gone out. It goes out, in fact, yeah, on Sunday night. We come out on Monday, so it would have gone out last night to anyone listening. And it is absolutely incredible. In this particular case, I know it's extraordinary, but I have to say James is right. And
whoa.
And I think
it
what
is September, yeah. Time is 2:28.
Yeah. So I have to give him credit. It is incredible. And I think what it reminds you of is it all goes back to The Godfather. So if you yes. think of the way The Godfather does set piece acts of violence.
Like this, the set piece.
Yeah. Think of that when you see the end, the climax of this particular episode. It's got that written all over it in a good way. I think, you know, there's a way of using that. It doesn't make it seem cliched and obvious, and it is just a spectacular piece of filmmaking, essentially. So yeah, that was brilliant. I think it is the best series of Peaky Blinders yet, which is pretty incredible considering how good it's been. I also want to mention Stathlet's Flats, in complete contrast, which is comedy that goes out on Channel 4 on Monday nights. Jamie Dimitriou and his sister, and it's about a doofus person who's trying to work in an office where they sort out short-term lettings, and it is... Series 1 was funny. Series 2 is fucking hysterically funny. Brilliant slapstick, brilliant silliness. It's incredible.
Hang on, didn't James... watch this. Wasn't this the source of some controversy on a recent podcast, because James watched it accidentally claimed we were meant to watch it and we didn't.
That's right.
Did he like it? I can't remember.
I think he quite liked it maybe, but I probably wasn't listening. I don't know. But it is, honestly, it's so funny. Yeah, it was a busy week, but Stathlet's Flats. Channel 4 is on a massive roll when it comes to comedy, because This Way Up is still on at the moment, reaching the end of that series, which has been incredible. Ashton B's show. You know, we had Game Face recently. It's doing really well comedy-wise. Well done, Channel 4.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the other thing I watched this week, just for a tonal shift, was Untouchable, The Rise and Fall of Harvey Weinstein, which aired, I think, 2 weeks ago, and we didn't review it that week again. I think it was a busy week. It's a feature-length documentary, a new documentary about Weinstein, with actresses and staff members who'd either allegedly been abused or had witnessed the abuse or had been part of kind of helping it go away at the time when they'd worked for Weinstein. And I have to say, I've read a lot and seen a lot about Weinstein, and it's not necessarily that there were explosive new revelations, because there weren't, but it was more a sense of... you really got to hear these women's stories. Some of the individual stories were so affecting and so brilliantly and sensitively handled, but they really got a chance to tell their stories in detail. I found it incredibly, incredibly moving. I don't know if you saw it at the time.
I did, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was incredible, absolutely phenomenal, yeah. Just because it's all from their point of view, isn't it? And that's the great thing about it, and to get them to talk about it on camera in such a detailed and, as you say, moving and just appalling, painting this portrait of this appalling human being. Yeah,
the testimonies were so powerful, because when normally in that kind of documentary, and I think it is to do with the feature length nature of it, because normally especially within an hour long documentary, it's all about the edit and everything being quite tight. Yeah. They stayed with particular women for a very long time and they allowed the story to unfold quite slowly. And so the amount of detail you got and the amount of understanding of the situation they've been, and then also they spoke very movingly, but again, in amazing detail about the consequences and kind of what they've lived with ever since. And the camera stayed with them. You know, somebody would break down into tears and the camera would stay with them while they didn't speak. And it was just clear the kind of emotional devastation that had been wrought. So if that sounds like your cup of tea, and if James was here, he'd be rolling his eyes at me and saying that I only like miserable things. It is on BBC iPlayer right now. Should we talk about news?
Yeah.
So the first thing I want to talk about is that Pilot TV, in conjunction with Empire, have published their best of TV 2019 list. This caused some debate in the office. mainly James is wrong. And it was mainly, I think it was how high can Star Trek Discovery be on this list was the main point. I think it's a really great list. We've got Stranger Things, Russian Doll, The Virtues, I Am, When They See Us, an amazing mix of American and British TV, kind of main channel, linear TV and streaming platforms. But the winner, the number one Empire and Pilots show of 2019 so far is The O.A., Boyd.
Yes, very exciting. And I did not fix this. This was a democratic decision. I was thrilled, and I think the OA fan base, because I actually didn't know when this thing was going up online on the website, and then suddenly there were loads of people online in the OA fan base going, oh, brilliant! You know, they've acknowledged the fact that this is an incredible show. So they were thrilled about that, and I think it's richly deserved. Yeah, just because it was such. I mean, even if forgetting the fact that it's been cancelled and everyone's furious about that, including me. It is just a unique, singular, unbelievable piece of creativity. So, yeah, it's fantastic. That's number one. Very pleased.
Amon, what do you think? I'm guessing you don't agree with our number one, or you maybe think there should have been something else.
I can't sort of add your comment on it because I don't watch the OA. I will. How many seasons do I need to catch up on?
Two.
Oh.
Yes. A mere 16 episodes. Okay, yeah, it's fine. You'll be fine. Do it over the weekend on the Netflix.
On the Netflix.
Okay. I'm going to get back to you on that.
Yeah.
I would probably say my number one would probably be When They See Us.
Yeah.
Just the acting in that is exceptional. The way Ava puts it together is incredible. It's very, very heavy. Like, I don't remember another sort of film or TV show that I've watched in which I've had to take regular breaks within the episodes because it's just too tough. But it's a very worthwhile watch, and I expect it to be very much in the thick of it when it comes to awards season.
Yes, I'm sure it will be. And it was in our either top five or top 10. I can't remember.
It's number five.
Number five. Yeah. We reviewed it really well on this podcast. So would that have been your number one or for the year?
Yeah.
That's strong.
I really like Mindhunter, the second season. Mm-hmm. Good. I'm spacing right now, but I've seen a lot of good TV.
It's been a good year. Yeah. Been a really, been a really good, year. Good year. Really good year.
Number two was Fleabag.
Yes.
Okay. Series two. Three was Chernobyl.
Chernobyl.
I want to watch that, but that came around. I came out around the same time as When They See Us, and I heard it was also.
Oh yeah, that's true. It did. Yeah, that was a heavy period for real life TV drama. Yeah. Four was Game of Thrones, which is really controversial. Four? Controversial, yeah. Just above When They See Us, which was five. Yeah, a lot of people. That's furious.
That is. Again, I demand a recount.
Wow. You see, I think it's fair enough because a lot of people were down on this series of Game of Thrones. It became a thing, how down people were on it. But I maintain that it's still up there as being fantastic television. I think if you stand back from it and go, look, this is still a brilliant thing. Even if you think it's a downturn from previous seasons, I still think it's up there as being a spectacularly fantastic television. So I'm with it. I'm down with it being.
Do you think it's too high?
Too high. Too high. And, you know, I've said often, when Game of Thrones is at its peak, there's nothing which can touch it. But, yeah, it doesn't maintain that level. And this season especially, I just think it's just too rushed. Too rushed. If they had the normal amount of episodes, that would have alleviated a lot of the issues which myself and many others had with it. Mm. But that was not the case.
Well, and you can't vote on that, but there is a poll currently on the Empire website, which is for the greatest TV shows of all time. Yes, which is quite the task. And if you would like to vote in that, because otherwise it is just going to be James voting for Star Trek and Banshee and Fire Escape over and over and over again, then just go to empireonline.com and you can find the poll there. What else have we got this week?
Will Poulter joining the cast of Lord of the Rings, the Amazon Prime version. I think it's... So we don't know who's going to play.
No.
No idea. But I feel that's strong. I love Will Poulter, pretty much. Even when he's in something not particularly great, like the Maze Runner films. He's still...
For example.
just plug that out. For example, he's still an incredibly charismatic screen presence.
Amazing.
Yeah, I love him.
Think about him in Detroit, right? Which was, what, 2 years ago? Yeah. And really went under the radar for lots of reasons I could never work out. I think it was a particularly strong year, I remember, in an awards season at that point. But he was absolutely outstanding in that. I think he's done such amazing projects over the last few years.
Yeah, brilliant in Midsommar this year. So I think it's so that makes me immediately, that casting makes me feel better about this whole project, because I am slightly cynical about the whole thing.
All of that,
right?
Because I've been a bit more on the series because I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy, as I'm sure everybody in this room does, and all the spin-offs, the prequels, the games. I've played or seen most of them, and they haven't gotten close to the quality of the films or the initial films. But Will Poulter, the guy is 26.
I know.
Wow. The way he's had already is just ridiculous. So, his casting definitely piques my interest, and I'll definitely check it out.
So in him we trust.
Yeah.
Actually, we should talk, and especially in James's absence, let's talk Mandalorian. So there were some pictures released this week and bits and bobs of new information. Amon, where are you on Mandalorian?
Excited to see it.
Yes.
This is going to say a very un-James-like thing. I am not the biggest Star Wars fan, but I am excited.
Whoa.
To see it.
Whoa.
We take back our you're just like James comments.
But I am excited to see it. I love the cast, Pedro Pascal, Gina Carano. I assume we're going to see Pedro Pascal's face at some point in the series.
Yes.
So, excited to see it, but I'm not sort of, chomping at the bit for it, as I'm sure a person who's not currently in this room is.
There was a quote.
I'm going to hear it from him as soon as he gets back.
Yeah, I'm sure. He's going to levitate into this room right now.
Yeah. No, I'm interested because I thought the trailer that we talked about last week looked incredible. And Jon Favreau, who is he the showrunner?
Yes, he is.
He said, he was quoted as saying it's like the first trilogy.
Yes.
In terms of I guess production value and storytelling and everything. And that's that's a bold thing to say. I mean, I guess he would say that, wouldn't he? But equally, he doesn't need to say it, So
I think from the trailer, he's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it really does look like proper Star Wars film that's going to be on TV every week.
But gritty as well.
Yeah.
Gritty. And him with Filoni, I just think, is dynamite because, you look at actually what Dave Filoni has produced across the entire universe. His storytelling output across so many mediums is unrivaled. And I don't think there's really any producer who knows the universe and the nuances of the storytelling as well as him.
I would agree. He kept, in that period where there was no Star Wars anything, he really kept that flame burning in a really cool way. And I reiterate, Clone Wars is great. Rebels was also very good. I've watched clips here and there from that. And all the Darth Vader stuff especially is really, really cool. It's one of the best ever Darth Vader comebacks, which I'm not going to try and imitate here, but...
Come on!
Oh,
you can't just throw that out and not deliver.
Okay. So, I can't remember what episode it's in. It's in Rebels, but Darth Vader, he sort of comes into this place. He's standing on top of a TIE fighter, and I think his name is Ezra. It's like, sort of like a Jedi in training.
Right.
And he's trying to be brave and step to Darth Vader. And I can't remember... He says as he's about to fight Darth Vader, I'm not afraid of you. To which Darth Vader responds, then you will die braver than most. And then it's
good.
Really cool. I highly recommend seeking it out. Because James Earl Jones sort of came back to do the voice for that as well, which is really cool. Because if you can cast James Earl Jones, you do it. And, Jon Favreau, did the same thing with The Lion King, rightfully so. So, I highly recommend seeking those shows out. They're really good.
And just like that, your James points have been reinstated.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Boyd?
Did you see that Wonder Woman director Patty Jenkins has got a massive deal with Netflix?
Yes.
So this is quite exciting. She can direct, write and produce loads of series. Basically, Netflix is now signing up every major talent out there who can write and direct stuff and produce stuff. And signing them up to their platform. So, you know, ongoing, you know, when it comes to, you know, in a few months' time, or in, you know, say in a year's time, when we've, when there's about five or six different streaming platforms that are all wondering how much, where to spend our money on, and you get slightly annoyed with them for cancelling the OA, but then you think, okay, they're giving really talented, interesting people the chance to do whatever the hell they want to do, pretty much creatively. I'm still, yeah, okay, it's still valid that you exist.
Well, let's also remember about Patty Jenkins. This is, I've got a bit of a beam up on it about this, which is, you know, she makes a film like Monster,
yeah,
and you know, award-winning, critically acclaimed, incredible film, and then struggles to essentially get another movie for what, like more than a decade.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And then when she got Wonder Woman, some people were like, oh, you know, well, can she handle this? Can she handle this? Something that is very rarely said about male directors, with at least, you know, there are men who've never made a feature film before who were given trust with big budgets and incredible titles. And it was kind of frustrating to see what happened to Patty. Yeah. And then she created, if you remember where DC was when Wonder Woman came out, after BVS, we all know. And BVS had done arguably so much damage to both, you know, the real hardcore fans, but also anybody who just dipped in and out of that universe before. And then she came along with Wonder Woman with such a bold vision, and the best DC film in so long is now making Wonder Woman 2, which I'm inordinately excited about. Everything we've seen so far, even the fucking poster, which is one of the best posters we've seen this year. I think she's incredible. This actually, I have to say, we talked previously about them putting the price up, as you say, and kind of taking friends away and what's going to be, what are we spending our money on? This made me really excited because I was like, actually signing a filmmaker like Patty is a really bold, interesting move. And being the home for When They See Us, right? So, you know, giving filmmakers like Ava, who's doing some of the best, most searing work right now, giving her a platform and seeing that go to so many people and not just receive critical acclaim, but you sense the real scale of people watching it.
Yeah.
Good for Netflix.
Totally.
Which is not something always said on this podcast. It's normally, why won't you show us your shows?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it is. Yeah.
I'm all for Patty Jenkins securing the bag, as they say.
Securing the what?
Securing the bag. Is that for it? Oh my God, it's another new phrase.
This is like a young people corner on the podcast.
It really is,
We'd like to invite one millennial on every episode, and they will tell us a phrase that we've never heard of. It's what? Secure the bag.
Secure the bag. That means that you're getting the money. You've landed a big gig. You're securing the bag.
I want to secure the bag. How do I secure the bag?
You got a pretty decent bag.
Am I all right? Yeah. Is my bag all right? And if I supply or secure... No, I don't supply the bag.
Now you're confusing me.
No, do I secure the bag or supply the bag?
Secure the bag.
Okay. Yeah. Can I secure more bag, or is that greedy?
You can secure more bag. No.
You can secure as many bags as you want.
Okay. Yeah. How much bag have you got, Boyd?
I've got a little bit of bag to secure, yeah. While we're talking about, can I quickly mention while we're talking about Netflix? Because a few people tweeted us about the Hateful Eight situation. Do you know about this?
Yes.
So the Hateful Eight was repackaged and reformed, if that's, I'm using random words here, but it was turned by Quentin Tarantino himself into a four-part Netflix version of that film, making it even longer than the three-hour version that was in cinemas. And it was on Netflix, and it is on Netflix, but not in the UK. And people were saying, you know, talking about it. So I think we mentioned it ages and ages and ages ago. And it's still not here in the UK. And I think, the only reason I mentioned it because people asked us about it on Twitter. And I think it is a rights issue. I think it's something to do with, you know, who distributed it here in the UK and Europe and what, and the different, I don't think they're doing it deliberately to keep us out of being able to see it. But that is why I think, and hopefully it will be resolved, because I do really want to see that as well, because I love The Hateful Eight. Just saying.
And actually, while we're talking about Friends, or I shouted it in passing, did you guys read this Friends essay that kind of went viral this week, which was this BuzzFeed
slagging it off,
which was Friends hasn't aged well, which was around the 25th. I mean, it's been lots of stuff around the 25th, right? But it's been doing the rounds for the last 4 or 5 days. I think it's Scarchy Cool, who's an amazing writer, has a big presence on Twitter, but it seems to have rubbed people up slightly the wrong way, because she talks about, you know, the fact that it's really not kind of very tactful or sensitive in places, especially, you know, about like Chandler's father who is transgender, and maybe Friends at the time, as a representation of its time, when you look back on it, it seems kind of quite offensive in places.
Yeah.
What do we think about that? Like, or do you think shows should just be a reflection of the time they're made?
Okay. Yes, I think they are a reflection of the time they're made. I think, I also think there's a difference between, so I read the piece and there was a lot of talk about how half the jokes, you know, that the men, half the jokes are kind of homophobic anyway, you know, about masculinity and about being gay. But I think at the time, well, I'm sure that at the time in real life, half the jokes between, particularly between men, about men were like that as well. And I think to expect, I think there's a difference between out and out homophobia depicting gay people in a certain way. It's the same as racism, you know, depicting non-white people in a certain way and having characters in a sitcom making jokes to each other about themselves and each other, which are, you know, when you analyze it, homophobic. I just think it's different. And I think it's totally understandable that Friends was that. Probably every single sitcom in the world was like that, including ones written by gay men. Frasier had a lot of episodes where, two or three of the best episodes of Frasier, when he was mistaken for being gay for one reason or another. And that's not, and these were written by gay men ran Frasier, and they were brilliant. And it was still essentially, you know, it was all about homophobia, but it's about that rather than using it to amuse people. And I think that's the difference. Seinfeld saying, there's a brilliant episode of Seinfeld where the whole running joke is not that there's anything wrong with that, i.e. being gay. And I wonder now if you presented any of these sitcom scripts to networks, whether they'd let you do them exactly as they did them back then because of sensitivity over these things. And that's probably right that you wouldn't do it exactly the same way now. But I think back then it seemed absolutely fine.
But do you think it's sensitivity or presumably times have changed? Because what you've just said is it's about intent, right? So there's no intent there for discrimination. It was about reflecting a certain reality in that world. Presumably the reason things have changed isn't necessarily because, you know, everybody's uber sensitive. It's because the world has changed.
Oh, completely, 100%.
You'd hope.
Yeah, I think the world has changed.
They wouldn't be relevant.
Totally,
Amon, do you think that's okay, if it is just, if you make the argument which Boyd is making, which is it kind of just reflects a reality, is that I don't want to manipulate your argument.
No, I am saying that. Yeah, I am saying that. Yeah,
I would largely agree. Everything's a product of its own time. I would not be surprised if in 20 years we're saying some of the stuff we're seeing today is you know sensitive and all the rest that they were saying about Friends. Just looking at sort of, you know, thinking about the show now, it's very, very white. And, you know, look at sort of all the conversation now we're having about race and TV shows and films. And that could be a criticism levied at it as well. But, you know, I still enjoy watching Friends. My sister, actually, she watches Friends all the time. I think she knows practically every episode verbatim at this point. It's actually insane. If there's ever a Friends quiz, holler at my sister. I still enjoy watching it, re-watching it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be, I think that's the other thing I meant to say, actually, is if you just sit down, I think to be offended by it is, I think you really have to work hard at it. I think that was what a lot of people's response to this piece was. It was like, really, you're really watching Friends, are you? And you're actually offended. And I'm not saying she wasn't, but I feel like that takes a lot of hard work for me to be offended by it.
But maybe for you, because you're a white guy,
but
right?
I know how much you love Friends.
I don't think
you're offended by it.
I'm also a white woman.
Yeah.
I think you have to be conscious of your perspective when you watch it, right?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
God, there's so much like agreement and a lack of discord.
Sickening.
I haven't called anyone a bellend.
Still time.
See what happens, James. I'm not saying you're the problem. Any more news before we go into reviews?
There's one bit of news which I found very interesting. A Sony CEO confirmed that they are developing 5 to 6 TV shows set in Spider-Man's universe.
We
have no details on what they might be, on if they're going to be connected to the new Spider-Verse that Sony are creating now that they have Spider-Man back. It could be Carnage, it could be Kraven. A while back, Spike Lee was linked to a Night Watch movie, and Gina Prince-Bythewood was reportedly working on a Silver Sable and Black Cat movie. Those could become TV show characters, we don't know. But yeah, it's definitely something to keep an eye on, especially given Disney are launching their sort of Marvel TV. Sony may even sort of wait to see how that goes before.
Yeah.
Really putting them.
It's a bit of a throwdown, right? In some respects.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it could work. It could work. They have cool characters, maybe not the name recognition, but you know, you think about where Iron Man was back in 2008. He was very B-list, C-list, and now he's a household name. Sony, you know, if they do it right, if they do it well, they could potentially elevate characters in a similar way. So
Feige free though, right? This is what I always put up against is the reason I don't have a moment's pause about Disney Plus. In terms of some of the shows will connect more than others. I don't worry about the storytelling or the production values or the quality, because Kevin Feige would not allow it to go out if it wasn't the same standard as the cinematic offering we're seeing at the moment. And that universe he's built is just extraordinary. And so that's the thing is, and they've said this week, right, that door is firmly, firmly, firmly shut.
Yeah, I was surprised and saddened to read that because I was holding out hope that maybe, maybe they'd come back to the table, but they didn't. But, you know, Sony have Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
They do.
And Into the Spider-Verse is not only the best Spider-Man film of all time, it was my favourite film of 2018. In the year that had Black Panther and Infinity War. And if you know anything about me, you know how much I love those movies. So that is a big statement to make, but Into the Spider-Verse is, for me, a perfect movie.
Yeah.
So if, you know, if Sony is smart, they'll put Phil Lord and Chris Miller at the helm of all this. And if that is the case, then that gives me a lot more confidence in it moving forward.
You might be right. I think you are right. See, yeah, more agreement. More agreement, more accord.
Yeah. Can I mention one more thing quickly?
Go on, Boyd.
Which was Valerie Harper, the star of Rhoda, which I mentioned last week. Because when I did Lou Grant, I banged on about that as being a spin-off from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And another spin-off of the show was Rhoda, which was very formative when I was growing up, watching this New York Jewish sitcom. And she was Rhoda, and she was absolutely phenomenal in it. And if people haven't seen it, I think you can get it on DVD. I think it might even be on iTunes. Honestly, it's like a Woody Allen film in the classic days of Woody Allen. Apologies regarding recent Woody Allen. I'm still watching Woody Allen films. I'm sorry.
Of course
but
you are.
It was
of
like 70s proper Woody Allen on TV, in TV sitcom form. And it was brilliant. It was like she had a classic Jewish mother who was spectacular. She was incredible. It was honestly, it was an incredible American sitcom. And she sadly passed away this week. Valerie Harper. There you go.
Valerie Harper died this week. Right. Now, this week's reviews. And first, we have Temple, the Mark Strong produced and starring thriller about Daniel Milton, a doctor gone very, very rogue. This is based on a 2017 Norwegian series called Valkyrien?
Yeah.
Valkyrien?
Yes. Valkyrian.
Valkyrian. I was going to try and do a Norwegian accent and then realised I don't know what Norwegian people sound like. And we all know how good my accents are. Boyd, you interviewed Mark Strong, didn't you? For the most recent issue of Pilot.
Yes.
Not that we're saying you're biased like we normally do.
Yeah, I'm always biased,
But what did you think of Temple?
I really liked it. So he's very proud of it. This is the first show I think he's exec produced, worked on it with his partner, who's a TV producer anyway. And so they saw I think they saw the pilot of the Norwegian version, which is basically, this doctor running this kind of sideline project of fixing criminals deep underground. And they went, oh my God, we could turn this into a great British thing. They flew over, got the rights in kind of, you know, quite quickly, and then went to work. And I think what they've done is they've created a really interesting bit of storytelling. I watched the first three episodes, and you're immediately thrust into a kind of almost like a, feel me, like a Coen Brothers-esque slightly kind of crime mystery thriller situation, which doesn't feel like it's going to attach itself to any particular genre. And it tells the story in a very intriguing and immediately captivating way. And I think there's a brilliant relationship with Mark Strong, who's this posh surgeon, and his sidekick is played by Daniel Mays, who's a working class transport employee. Their relationship is instantly fascinating and intriguing. Then you've got something's happened with Mark Strong's wife, that she's been ill, and you're not quite sure how that fits in with the idea that he's become this rogue person operating underground, deep underground, in disused London Underground stations. There's so many intriguing elements to it. And then Carice Van Houten from Game of Thrones is one of his colleagues, who she gets embroiled in the situation in a really interesting way. It's beautiful to look at, fantastically well shot. The music is really interesting, I think. It's kind of unusual, kind of mix of orchestral, electronic music.
So it's an electronica composer called Matthew Herbert, right? And I wrote this down because I thought the score was like totally took me by surprise. And the way they use it throughout the episode as a storytelling device, especially in the last kind of 10 minutes or so, I was blown away by that. And it was totally not what I was expecting from something like this.
Yeah, the music is incredible. And I think they're so proud of the music. They did a special screening this week where they did a live orchestral accompaniment, which I couldn't make it to. So I think it's a really intriguing, and they're doing a nice thing where there's flashbacks and flash forwards, and the flashbacks are in a different aspect ratio, just so you know where you are, which you don't necessarily notice immediately, but I notice after a while. It's just a really well-made, captivating, intriguing story, and I can't wait to watch the rest of it.
See, I've only watched the first episode. I've got to say, I wasn't grabbed by it, although the twist at the end made me want to keep watching. That was really, really good. Did not see that coming. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, though, I'm not sure that I'd be sort of chomping at the bit to return. But thankfully, that's how it ended. And you said you've seen the first three, so hopefully it gets better.
Yeah, I was slightly wrong-footed by it, because when it started, and it is, I mean, it's slightly, can we just say it's slightly ridiculous, right?
So the
moments you're like, what the fuck is happening? So, you know, he runs down to these tunnels, it's deep under, I mean, it looks amazing. Mm. Like, let's just say that it does look amazing. There are some incredibly graphic surgery scenes done kind of in this DIY, and he's got blood all over his shirt, which is opened a little bit, and he's very serious all the way through, and he's like, and yeah, Daniel Mays is this like rough criminal who's like running around. And there are bits where you're like, this is trippy. But it does pull it back to being more, because I thought, oh, this is kind of quite a pulpy, overblown thriller in some respects, but then when you start to see the flashbacks, it's much more of a considered drama, and it's the shift between those things which I found really interesting. Like you say, Amon, there's you know, my attention was drifting a little bit, and we can't say any more about what the twist is because it's worth waiting for, but that is, it is genius, and it's so brilliantly used because I want to watch the second episode
it's
now,
so
right?
Cleverly done.
It's brilliantly done. It's
absolutely
brilliantly done.
Also, like Chekhov's puddle with blood in the first episode.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that, and the way they do the twist in the end of the first episode, so then when you watch the next two episodes that I've watched, how that all spans out is so interesting. It's absolutely intriguing. Yeah, so it gets more and more kind of captivating. He was really keen. He was going on about how he really hopes people do watch those first three because they're kind of like a thing in itself, and then it's going to play out for another kind of five or six episodes. Yeah.
Oh, so the three together are kind of one almost complete piece.
Yes, that's in a way. Yeah. So for example, the flashbacks will stop at the end of episode three, and then it's just set in the present day pretty much. So the kind of story of how it's all involving his wife and all of that plays out across those three episodes. Yeah.
Interesting, because it does that. Those first 10 minutes, I thought I knew exactly where I was. You know, there's a gang, and everybody's doing exactly what you expect them to do. But get through the first quarter, because the first quarter is just setting up your expectations just to kick the fuck out of them, essentially. What is disconcerting is I think our diet of TV at the moment is so high quality, but also everything is fits a very particular shape, and this is kind of unsettling in that it doesn't, but I think it's part of what makes it exciting. Is this a Sky One original?
It is. Well, I was going to say that. So this is Sky One original, and I feel like, you know, probably 2 or 3 years ago it would have been Sky Atlantic because it is such a high level of production values and you know, it's a quality. I think this is going to end up being one of the best things that's been on Sky One because it's Sky One.
And it's just coming after Brassic, right? Which was another Sky One originally. Which is a proper twofer, I have to say.
Yes.
Twofer. Is that what twofer means?
I think so, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I never knew. I just heard somebody else using the phrase twofer, and I was like, I am totally going to use it and like see how it goes down, apart from I wasn't sure what it really meant. Temple will be on Sky One on Friday the 13th of September.
Correct. And you'll be able to watch the whole thing and the whole box set as well from that night, I believe.
Excellent, excellent. Next, we have Top Boy, which last aired on Channel 4 6 years ago after winning a bucket full of awards and after two seasons. It's now been revived for a third by Netflix, by a team including the actual Drake. And the actual Drake turned up at the premiere this week at Hackney Picture House, which was amazing to see. Amon, do you want to kick us off on Top Boy?
Yeah, so Top Boy was a show that I watched when it started back in the day, but I have not caught up with it and kept up with it. But watching this episode made me want to go back and catch up with it properly and sort of, you know, reacquaint myself with the show, because it's really, the first episode is really, really good. It features a lot of good men making bad decisions, good and bad reasons.
Yeah.
Watching characters struggle with that is compelling TV, especially when the characters are played by Ashley Walters, who is really, really good as Duchesne. You can see him fight with that, that internal struggle without him actually saying much. And that's great acting. I also like the authenticity of Black Britain. I like the authenticity of Jamaica. These are places you don't see that often on screen depicted like this, and I appreciated that. And just, I love how the themes of family and loyalty are really tied into all the significant characters and how that plays itself out. So I'm really, really excited to continue watching this. It's a really good first episode. No sign of Kano or Letitia Wright yet, but I'm looking forward to them making appearances too.
Is Letitia Wright back?
I've heard that she is.
That would be amazing if they got her back. Yeah, I agree with that. I thought their commitment to authentic language was really important in terms of when they're in Jamaica, you know, and when they're in London, there isn't an attempt to kind of make it sound a little bit more mainstream for people. And their commitment to that is kind of just one example, I think, of the authenticity in this show. And it's always been about that naturalistic, super real just representation of these communities and these lives, which we so rarely see on screen. And they haven't lost that at all. And I just thought Ashley Walters is just incredible. Absolutely incredible. It looks absolutely fantastic. Boyd, you're nodding. Were you a fan?
Yeah, I find the extraordinary thing about Top Boy is that it's created by a 60-something Irish guy, Ronan Bennett, who is still writing. He's written this first episode and still heavily involved. And it's extraordinary. You know what they say sometimes? In fact, they said this recently I watched a few interviews with creators of different shows recently where they said, this was my story to tell. You know, they're talking about how they're from a certain community and they felt they wanted to write about their story. And this is not, you could say, if you wanted to, this is not his story to tell, because he is not a young 16-year-old black guy living in East London. I think it all started, we've done an oral history, in our current issue of Pilot TV about this, from the producers, and they explained how he was observing where he lived, his locale in East London. And that's how it all started way back when.
Yeah, it was a particular thing, a 10-year-old.
Yeah, and he watching 10-year-old
dealing drugs. Right?
So I think actually, it just shows you that those rules, you know, if you start kind of saying this is what you should and shouldn't do about creating stuff, that maybe sometimes there are exceptions. I think this is a massive exception. Because I think apart from, you know, he's got everyone else working on the show.
That's important, he's surrounded himself with people.
Exactly. So, but I just think it's an interesting point that he has created this whole thing, essentially. But I watched it at the time, and I remember at the time thinking, first of all, Ashley Walters, you know, who was part of So Solid Crew, was like acting his ass off brilliantly. He's so even better now. I mean, now he's like in this,
he's just
so much he has to do, and he's absolutely incredible. Looks great with a beard, by the way, in episode one when he's in Jamaica. And I just thought it's even more important now, because obviously now with knife violence being an incredible thing which it will deal with in the series quite strongly, it's kind of repetitive learned behaviour that, you know, still kids will get involved in this stuff in their locale, and how do you avoid it, and how do you get into it, and why is one kid getting embroiled in this and why is another kid not? It deals with all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, where is the morality? How do you stop yourself from kind of doing wrong and getting involved in violence? It's just fascinating. So I was very impressed with this episode. And I just think it's amazing that it took Drake, partly to Drake. So I think they showed it in the States.
So Netflix had bought the rights to the first two seasons, showed it. He loved it and tweeted. And then I think directly got in touch with Ashley and was like, this is amazing. How is it not a third season? Yeah. Why didn't a third season get made by Channel 4?
Well, I think because probably at the time ratings weren't incredible. You know, it was a gritty, you know, quite bleak, very, very real and authentic series. And it wasn't because it wasn't particularly, I don't know, soapy, or it was a proper quality piece. I don't think that ratings were huge back then. So they didn't give him a third series, but they always wanted to do a third series, and now, thank God, they've been able to do it. And I think it's great. I think we were talking about Netflix Germany before. Another example of when sometimes they just do great things, which is revive Top Boy. It's one of the least likely things you'd ever get them to do, but it's brilliant. They've done it.
I just hope it manages to sustain the quality, because season one and season two of Top Boy were 4 episodes each. This is a 10 episode season.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'll be interested to see that. And to your point earlier, it just goes to show you that if you embed yourself in the culture, then you can create authentic content. Yeah. And actually, I watched Inner the Yard, a movie, documentary came out a week and a half ago, about sort of Jamaican, the roots of reggae. That's directed by Peter Weber. He's but it's a really good documentary because he embedded himself in that culture. He surrounded himself with the right people. He let the people on camera actually tell their story and gave them the time and the space to do that. It's another exception in this case, but it can happen.
It's behaving with care and consideration, right? And caring about telling nuanced stories that reflect reality and not some kind of trope or an easy thing, because this isn't easy, actually. There's a lot of violence. And as you say, there's like bad guys making bad decisions. There's good guys making bad decisions. It's that entire kind of like tapestry of morality and right and wrong and circumstance, as you say, Boyd, and kind of the society we live in and the pressures that plays and the role that plays has to be handled so delicately. And I think it takes filmmakers who really give a shit about creating something real, not something easy and kind of that's just going to grab the headlines or tell a certain version of that story, which a certain part of the audience would, you know, swallow wholeheartedly, as opposed to this, which is challenging and interesting and not easy at all, but all the more real and brilliant for it, right?
Yeah, completely, yeah.
Boyd, when's it on?
Top Boy is on, starts on Friday the 13th as well.
Wow, Friday the 13th is a good, good day.
It is.
Good, good day, Friday the 13th. It's also the evening of the Pilot TV podcast at the London Podcast Festival with our very special guest, Russell Tovey. There are still a few tickets left. Consider this your final warning. Oh, no, that sounds like a lorry reversing.
Yeah. You turn to a klaxon.
Woo, woo,
yeah.
Woo,
oh, yeah, yeah. That's good noise.
Woo, woo. Yeah. Sorry about that. It's just what you want on a podcast is somebody trying to do an alarm sound at you. There are still a few tickets left at kingsplace.co.uk. So you can watch the Pilot TV podcast in person, talk to us, meet us, touch Russell Tovey's hair, right, Boyd?
Yeah, I think we'll be fine with that, yeah.
And then you can go home and watch An Embarrassment of Riches that has been released that day. But we're not done yet, because finally this week we have Unbelievable, a new Netflix true crime series based on an episode of radio show This American Life and the Pulitzer Prize winning article An Unbelievable Story of Rape by journalist T. Christian Miller. The story looks at how a teenager's rape allegation is doubted and dismissed by male detectives, while hundreds of miles away, two female cops are looking into very similar cases. It stars Caitlin Dever, who starred in Booksmart earlier this year, Toni Collette and Merritt Wever. The showrunner is Susanna Grant, the writer of Erin Brockovich. Stellar, stellar, stellar all the way round. Obviously, this is peak me. I love this. I love this so much that last night I stayed up till 2 a.m. watching 3 episodes because I couldn't leave it after one. I fucking love this. I mean, I love Caitlin. I have to say, like, Booksmart is one of my films of the year. She's incredible in it. This couldn't be more different in terms of the character she plays. I loved everything about this, the kind of authenticity, the way it was shot in a super interesting way. So there are several kind of scenes where she's with the police, these two detectives we're talking about. It's shot in such an intense and claustrophobic and close way that you are totally, the tension is unbearable. I had to stop it at one point because I couldn't keep watching it. The way it deals with kind of the systemic problems around sexual assault, which are around disbelief, which are around some kind of traditional detectives, in this case, willingness to believe women, especially if the stories are a little bit complicated. And actually the contrast with Toni Collette and Merritt Wever, who play these incredibly sensitive kind of, but hard ass, but very, very sensitive female cops is extraordinary. And I just think Kathleen's amazing because what she conveys, especially in the first couple of episodes, is this sense of what happens when you're not believed. And she's a girl who's been through loads of trauma. And he's just trying to survive. There are lots of flashbacks, which are quite... The way they tell the story is really interesting because the flashbacks are used to show the trauma of constantly having to relive and reaccount your sexual assault, which happens to a lot of women in that scenario. You have to tell your story over and over again, which is itself traumatizing. Instead of just showing her telling her story over and over again, they use the same flashbacks over and over again, which I think is a really, really smart storytelling device. Three episodes in, I like can't wait to get home tonight so I can watch some more. What else did we think?
I would concur with practically everything you just said. I've only seen the first episode, but the first episode is masterful. The way in which that is put together is just great, from how they stage the seeds of doubt.
Yes.
How they introduce the various flashbacks that inform her mental state. Just incredibly put together, and just really, I love how it put you in the headspace of the character from the word go. You know, she has to, as you say, recount the story over and over and over again. That's upsetting. The cold and detached way in which the male detectives are questioning her in the first episode is also upsetting. I'm 1.5 episodes in because I was chomping at the bit to watch more of this as well. And the marked difference between how the male detectives treat the victim in the first episode and how the female detectives treat the victim in the second episode is incredible.
Do you know what? I actually thought there was a time jump. I rewound it because I thought there was a time jump of like a decade or something because the contrast was so great. Yeah. I thought, if I'm mistaken, it was that in the 90s and this is because it's 2011, I think. And I was like, hang on, is it 10 years apart? Because as you say, the contrast was remarkable. It was like two different generations.
Yeah, just the sensitivity and respect, which was lacking in the first episode. You got that here. I can't wait to watch more. I didn't know about this story beforehand, and that's one of the great things about what we do, and that they can illuminate these type of things which people don't have heard about. So I'm intrigued to sort of watch this and then do all the research to find out about the real life case, and it's got me to that level of interest with one episode, and that's impressive.
I had to stop myself Googling last night because I was like, I want, because obviously that will unfold the whole story for me, right? And I was like, I'm going to read this and I'm going to listen to this podcast. And then I was like, no, I shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I did Google it. I wrote a thing in Pilot TV about it. I watched the first three episodes before I wrote that piece. And what immediately struck me was, it's like, for me, it's an object lesson in how to do this kind of thing, how to tell a true crime story, which essentially could be done in we've reviewed some of them on this podcast where they end up being a bit cheesy, a bit weird, a bit almost sometimes too tasteful, sometimes too kind of bland in a way, because they feel they have to respect the people, especially living people involved. I just think this is so, it's perfectly handled, isn't it? And that, right from that first episode where the detail of what happens to anyone who's been raped, and then how that is going to be investigated with men leading that investigation, which I don't think would happen anymore, certainly not in this country. I think that, but it certainly did happen then, and I think probably still does in America in certain places, is grueling and intense and horrendous, but so authentic. It seems, and you're taken step by step through that process. Incredibly brilliantly done. And then once the detective is introduced in episode 2, I think, you don't see him in episode 1, played by Merritt Weaver, who is unbelievably great.
She's so soulful. Yeah.
Isn't she? It's like, as soon as you see her, you're like, oh, you know, you're dealing with a human being.
The way she walks. Do you know what was really interesting? You first see her in the car and she gets out the car. She starts to walk. And I was like, I was really like thrown off by it. She walks in like, I know it sounds stupid to say somebody walks like they've got a soul, but she did. The way she walked and carried herself and her manner.
Because the bloke detectives and the other half of the story are just, and they're not even monstrous. They're not monstrous. There's a great bit where they have a little chat to each other after they've interviewed the girl for about the second or third time. And that's a brilliant scene to show they're not monsters. They think they're doing the job. They think they're doing the right thing. And that was brilliantly handled. I just think it's so it's the texture of it is so brilliantly done. You almost can't, you know, it reminded me a little bit of When They Sizz, because that was fantastically handled. Or, you know, it felt so true every step of the way. This does as well. And I agree. And Caitlin Deva is just, I mean, she has to go through a lot. And it's just so incredible how she handles it all. And I love Booksmart as well. Is fantastic. But to see this whole completely, she's so funny in that. She's so, you know, real and authentic. And it's someone dealing with trauma, this, you know, almost ultimate trauma. It's just a brilliant piece of, again, filmmaking, TV. It is unbelievably good.
It's also just nice to see a character who's really good at their job be good at that.
You know,
it's just nice.
Yeah,
I was like watching that.
Yeah, but as you say, Boyd, the way they humanized everybody in it, so that it was, because it's so easy in that scenario, right, to be they're evil and they're out to kind of get all women, and but you don't get the sense they do believe her, and there's doubts for certain reasons and inconsistencies, because, you know, she's been through a traumatic event and she's recounting it over and over again, and she may miss a detail out here that she told to a friend over here. And they kind of manipulate her in a way. They, you know, they use tactics that they'd use against the suspect, which is presumably the way they're trained. And that conversation you're speaking of is fascinating, because one of the guys in particular is very sympathetic.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, they both get to the same place of, you know, dismissing her and kind of...
I think it makes you think about the whole idea of false accusers as well. The idea that once someone is deemed... they've made a false accusation, even legally, you know, if they're found guilty of it, that, you know, you've got to look at that more closely. It's not necessarily the same, you know, for all of these different people. And I think this whole story, which is a true story, and everything that's going to play out, all happened, I think will make people rethink about the way they talk about that whole idea of false accusations, and what, you know, why people end up saying things, and particularly in police interviews, that they may not actually think, and they may not, you know, they just end up, people end up, it's false confessions. It's another, you know, it's the same kind of thing we've seen in Making a Murder and other things like that. People say stuff in four kinds of reasons, and it's kind of, it's terrifying, really. It's like a nightmarish situation. Yeah. But
this actually reminded me of the Jussie Smollett case.
Yeah.
In many ways, talk about false accusations and how that played out. I'm excited to also get out of here so I can continue watching.
Yes. So that's Friday as well. It's Netflix.
Friday the 13th.
Yeah,
it's weird, isn't it? And this other one that I want to quickly mention is also Friday the 13th.
Go on, Boyd.
So on Amazon Prime, there's a new animated show called Undone, which is from two of the creators of BoJack Horseman. Don't let that put you off. I'm not a BoJack fan.
No.
You may be. I don't know. No, fine.
Nobody on this podcast is.
No. This is a really good, honestly, animation. It's done in the rotoscope style. You know, of those, it's kind of very almost realistic, the pace of the animation. It's kind of like, you know, I think they basically take people, actors interacting, and they kind of trace over almost. This is a very simplistic animation, to be furious with me. But it's got that kind of ultra-realistic form to it, rather than, you know, kind of the BoJack Horseman kind of thing. So it's completely nothing like that. It's got a very real feel, but intriguingly, it's about a woman who, in the very first scene, is in a car crash, and from then it's all about how that then affects her, how affects her mind and her thoughts, and almost time seems to bend and things happen out of order, and it's kind of delving into her mind, and it's so really, really well done how they use the form of this rotoscope animation to kind of show you what's going on in her mind and her world. It's really, really good. And she's played by Rosa Salazar of Alita Battle Angel fame, who's clearly specialising in doing CGI animated versions of her. It's really interesting.
I have problems with Alita Battle Angel. Not one of them.
No, she's great, We all have problems with Alita Battle Angel.
And when does that drop, Boyd?
Friday the 13th.
It's
the week of stuff happening all
on
Friday
the 13th. Fuck it, take the day off work. I give you permission to take the day off
and
work.
And then come to see us.
Apart from if you work for me, do not take the day off work.
Yeah, we've actually got our internal awards on that day.
And may I remind you,
what a day.
Internal awards, the pilot podcast, the day of dreams.
Day of dreams.
So, what are our picks of the week?
I'm saying Unbelievable, I think.
Come on. Unbelievable for me too. Yeah, God damn it. James is going to be furious. Unbelievable is our pick of this week. Now, Banshee. We're going to Banshee sans James.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
Just because, you know, I couldn't bear him choosing the Darling Buds of May or some other small niche show that nobody's ever heard of. Boyd, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I was thinking of animated shows, Quiz of Undone, which is one of the best animated shows I've seen for a long time. I'm not a huge fan of animated shows, so I've seen this podcast before, but one thing I did love was back, way back when was it? In the 90s, in the mid-90s, The Critic, which was kind of a spin-off of The Simpsons, which a lot of people didn't see and a lot of people still haven't heard of, I think. That's why I'm banshing it. There were 23 episodes of it. It was first shown on ABC, then it finished its run on Fox. It was created by Al Jean and worked on The Simpsons. And it was all about John Lovitz voiced about a film critic. It was an animated series.
That sounds awful.
About a film
critic.
I'm
sorry. No. Like, why would you want an animated series about a fucking film critic? Because all you do is sit in a dark room.
No.
Argue with other film critics.
Because then it would spoof. So it would spoof the kind of films he was criticising. So there was Apocalypse Now the Musical, etc., which I remember very well. And so they would have these wonderful animated little kind of moments shown from the films he was reviewing. Then you got to see his life, his and kind of why he was a kind of slightly irritating, classic male, white, middle-aged film critic type thing. It was a critique of that type of person. Honestly, you'll love it.
Did it air over here?
Yeah, it aired over here briefly, I think. I mean, I can't even remember what channel it was on over here. Probably, I think it was probably on Sky, because I think it was, you know, part of the Simpsons package, but I may be wrong. It may have been on Channel 4 or something. And the one other thing is that the theme tune was by Hans Zimmer, randomly.
What?
Yes, I know.
Hans Zimmer.
Yes.
Hans Zimmer scoring a piece of animation about parodying film critics.
Yeah. What more can you want? See, I buried the lead and I've got you there with that final fact.
That's proper spun me out. Yeah. This is like Inception.
It is. The Critic.
Yeah. I'm on, follow that.
I'm actually going to change my earlier. I'm going to say that a show that you should check out is an animated show. It's on Netflix right now. It's called Transformers Prime. And I'm a big, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, Boyd, already.
Did you just sigh, Boyd?
No, I kind of was like, what?
Justify myself, okay? Now, I'm a big sort of Transformers fan. And
somebody has to be.
And yeah, I know James is actually as well, so.
Somebody has to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, like many, I've been disappointed with the way the Michael Bay films turned out. I really liked Bumblebee last year. But everything that you wanted from the films, you get in this series, which is just great. Peter Cullen, once again, reprises his role as Optimus Prime. And Peter Cullen, it's like, I feel the same way about Peter Cullen as I do with Kevin Conroy and Batman. You just, if it's not them voicing the characters, it just doesn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Cullen is just amazing in the voice role. And, you know, we get Megatron as he's meant to be. We get Optimus Prime as he's meant to be. The action is great. The human characters who are annoying in the films, the human characters are great in this. Everything that you could want from the films, you get in this show. It lasted 3 series, I think, and had a movie at the end of the series. All of that is on Netflix right now. I highly recommend checking out. The score as well is by Brian Tyler, who is great, big fan, and his main theme is excellent. So, yeah, if I can get more people to check out Transformers Prime, that would be...
I'm just trying to find it on my Netflix. So I could probably say it's a fully animated thing.
Yeah. But, I mean, the action is great. If you type into YouTube sort of Optimus Prime versus Megatron, it will probably... there's a fight which I'm thinking of, which is just incredible. It's actually, it reminds me of... one of the fights is in Equilibrium, would you believe? But it's really, really good. And yeah, unfortunately, it came out around the same time as the Transformers films, and a lot of people were, you know, rightfully crapping on it. But the show is great. And I promise you, if you are any kind of Transformers fan, give it a chance, you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I can confirm it does exist. I'd never heard of it, I have to say. Yeah.
Wow. I don't know if we've ever had something that Boyd has never heard of. You've achieved the impossible. You've achieved the impossible. I'm kind of torn because it's like Transformers versus film critic parody.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm in the seventh circle of hell right now.
Yeah.
But probably I'm going to have to go Boyd.
Thanks.
I know. You got me with Hans Zimmer.
Yeah. Like, Hans Zimmer.
You got me too.
Yeah. Thanks.
Hans Zimmer, I'm a massive sort of film.
Yeah, I knew I'd get you with that.
And he is the guy who opened my ears to what film music can do. Gladiator is still my favourite score of all time. I don't see that ever changing.
Wow.
Even I'm like, I gotta check that out.
Yeah. The next time you see him doing one of his concerts, you can shout out, "Do the Critic" at him.
He'll be like, "How is that one person remembered?"
Yeah.
Who gave that one person access to that show? Yeah. Stop it.
I was at his concert in Wembley a couple of years back. It was incredible. Just, yeah, he's a showman. I love him.
Right. And that is it for another Pilot TV podcast. Until next week, do converse with us on Twitter at Terry_White, at Boyd Hilton. I'm on what's your handle?
At A Woman Two Ends.
Okay, and please drop...
Wait a minute, is this a bit where I talk about Blue Bloods?
Oh my God! Not again!
Oh yeah, that's right.
Hi Chris.
It's time to talk about Blue Bloods, motherfuckers.
Do the Skeksis.
Naughty, naughty!
I'm as much as I don't want to upset James by coming up with a franchise that doesn't revolve entirely around him, we should create one which revolves entirely around you.
Oh, I like it.
And have you coming in at the end of every show.
Well, Chris does the Skeksis.
Yeah, Chris does the Blue Bloods. You could do the history of Blue Bloods just in the last 5 minutes of the podcast. It could span out over the next 20 years. In the Skeksis voice. Yeah. I think it's going to work.
Give it a go on.
A family of New York policemen. The Reagans. The commissioner is Tom Selleck. And his dad, the worst character in the history of television, that's what it is played by an actor just 6 years older than Tom Selleck.
And next week, Chris will be back to do part two. I was going to say, please leave 5 of your very best stars on our iTunes reviews page. I think after that, we'll take 2, 3 if you're feeling generous. Do join us next week when Chris will be back, as will our very own Theresa May, James Dyer, who will be dancing badly back into our lives, by which point maybe the country will have imploded. But until then, Pilot out.
Naughty, naughty!